Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 262nd episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the greatest songwriters of all time, a one-woman hit machine for more than 35 years, who has worked with almost every major singer of that time span, from Barbara Streisand and Cher to Celine Dion and Whitney Houston to Beyoncé and Lady Gaga, and who is responsible for giant hits like How Do I Live, I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, If I Could Turn Back Time, Rhythm of the Night, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now, Because You Love Me, Don't Turn Around, Unbreak My Heart, Can't Fight the Moonlight, and so many others. The great Diane Warren, of whom the legendary music industry executive Clive Davis once said, quote, "You know how people are always saying no one writes songs like they used to? Well, Diane is someone who does," close quote. Warren was the most successful songwriter of the 1990s, has been called the High Priestess of Heartbreak, and is virtually synonymous with the power ballad, but has found success with almost every genre. She has had 32 songs crack the Billboard Hot 100 chart and 9 top it. She was the first songwriter to simultaneously have songs at number 1 and number 2 on the U.S. charts, and she was the first songwriter to simultaneously have 7 songs by 7 different artists on the singles chart at the same time. Furthermore, she has written more than 100 songs that have been featured in movies, 10 of which brought her Best Original Song Oscar nominations, but none yet a win. Meanwhile, she has won Grammy, Emmy, Golden Globe, and Critics' Choice Awards, each for different songs. She also won the Billboard Music Award for Songwriter of the Year in 1997, 1998, and 1999, was named the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers Pop Songwriter of the Year in 1990, 1991, 1993, 1998, and 1999, and their Country Songwriter of the Year in 2000, and she was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2001. Today, at 62, she is still going strong and pumping out songs as great as ever. And over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, she and I discussed all of the above, plus much more, including how she emerged from a troubled childhood and first began working in the music biz, the origin stories of her greatest hits, several of which almost never were, and what inspired the trilogy of call-to-action songs that have accounted for her 3 most recent Oscar noms, Till It Happens to You, from 2015's The Hunting Ground, performed by Lady Gaga, Stand Up for Something, from 2017's Marshall, performed by Andra Day and Common, and from the 2018 Ruth Bader Ginsburg biodoc RBG, which itself has been nominated for the Best Documentary Feature Oscar, the song I'll Fight, performed by Jennifer Hudson. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Diane, thank you so much for coming in. It's good to see you as always. And this is a little different than most of these because usually when somebody comes on this podcast, I don't really previously know them, don't have much to do with them. I feel like thanks to the long suffering period that you've had with the Oscars, number, yeah. 10 different
nominees. We're old friends.
We're old friends. So I've only been around for the last 4, I think. Before that was before my time. So
I feel like I've known you longer than
yes, that. But it's been fun and we'll get through all of it. But I guess to begin with, let's just say for the record, where were you born and raised and what did your parents do for a living?
I'm from Van Nuys, California. I'm a local, not a lot of us. My dad sold insurance. My mom was a housewife.
And was music a big presence in the house growing up?
Yeah, I have 2 older sisters. One's 11 years older than me. One's 14 years older. So, I was born and they were already playing records, of the day. And my mom and dad listened to a lot of show tune albums. Mm-hmm. So I got to hear, I heard such a wide variety of music, just being born.
And when did you first sort of arrive at the realization that songs actually come from somewhere as opposed to out of thin air, that there are actually people who write these.
I mean, they don't come out of thin air. Oh, I didn't ever think about it until I looked on a single. Remember, kids, there used to be things called singles. Yes. There were 45s. They were like these round things, and they had little parentheses with songwriters' names on them, so you don't have to go to Spotify and find the wrong information. Oh, don't get me started. And, I remember seeing the song Up on the Roof.
Yeah.
And it said Gothen King. And I'm like, oh, those are the songwriters. I don't know if maybe I asked a question. I go, I want to be in there. I want to be in the parentheses.
Yes, because they would put the songwriters' names in parentheses.
Yeah.
That's great.
And I didn't want to be the singer or the artist. Like, even from when I was a kid, I go, I'm going to be that. And I think I was kind of dabbling, on my little guitar that my dad brought me back from Mexico at the time.
Well, so that's interesting, though, that, a lot of kids want to grow up and be the voice that everyone's hearing. Why do you think?
No one wants to hear my voice. No,
but even at that point, you were not at all thinking it would be cool to also sing the songs I want to write.
I didn't think for one second it would be cool to sing the songs I wanted to write. I mean, I didn't have any desire to get on a stage or be in a group or, you know, anything like that. I kind of like always loved the idea of, you know, just being the one writing the songs.
What was the first album or single or whatever that you remember buying yourself?
Buying myself or having my mom make it?
Or making your mom buy it.
Meet the Beatles by the Beatles.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the first album I ever bought.
And I think I remember you saying once that you also went and saw them live a few times out here in LA, right?
The benefit of having older sisters, I saw the Beatles twice at the Hollywood Bowl and Dodger Stadium.
Oh, wow. And was that sort of a major experience for you?
Oh, yeah. But you know what? There was a lot of screaming going on. Yeah. I remember at the Hollywood Bowl, I understand why, didn't they? I think they kind of quit and decided to not tour. But you know what's crazy? When you think of this, this is kind of mind-blowing. It still blows my mind. The whole Beatles catalog that we know of in America was 7 years.
That's nuts.
Isn't that crazy? So from when I Want to Hold Your Hand till Let It Be, or it was seven years from Magical Mystery Tour and Sgt. Pepper and Abbey Road, all that stuff. I mean, that catalog of that creativity in those songs, it's kind of, and then nowadays people are like, oh yeah, I'm doing my album. It'll be out in a few years.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
well, so
when they do albums.
Yeah. Right. So basically you're growing up surrounded by, you know, a music revolution growing up in the 60s.
Cause I grew up in the best time.
Right. I mean, cause you got Beatles, you got Motown, you got all this stuff.
Everything. Like to me, that's truly the golden age of songwriting.
And so was that the reason why it sounds like you were not particularly diligent about schoolwork? You were a little bit of a acting out as a rebel in school, like
juvenile delinquent
to the point where literally it sounds like you went to juvenile hall a couple times.
A few times.
Ran away once for a few weeks. Like what
I
was
came
at
back
the root
I missed
of
my cat.
You missed your cat.
Yeah.
So, but you were literally, you know, when you did run away at 14, you were with a
bad
rough
kid. I did. Yeah, I was with some rough people. I was staying with bank robbers and stuff. I just didn't, like, I got kicked out. I was getting kicked out of school for the second time. I was kicked out of Mulholland Junior High, and I went to Northridge Junior High, and I was caught mid-flipping off the teacher.
Not
surprise,
you.
Surprise, surprise. Yeah. And she goes, that's it, you're behind the principal. And I knew if I did one thing, I was getting kicked out. And then my friend goes, you can stay with some friends of mine, you know? She didn't kind of tell me they happen to be, like, bank robbers on the run from the law and heroin addicts. And
so literally, while you're 14, you're with these kids.
Yeah, I stayed with these people.
But
I was close to 14 or 15. And I was just like embarrassed. I was getting kicked out of school again. So I stayed with these. I mean, someone was shooting up heroin and asked me to hold the thing. And I'm scared of needles. And I almost fell down and, you know, passed out.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't want to be around these people. This is not where I'm supposed to be.
But the thing that you were running from was having responsibilities other than focusing on writing songs, which
is
what
you wanted
to do.
Yeah, it was like going to school, and I was always a rebel, and I just wanted to sit in those classrooms and do shit I didn't care about, you know? I mean, nothing interested me except music.
So what got you, at least for a little while, back on the straight and narrow? You had a little incentive program.
Have I ever been? What got me back? Well, okay, I missed my cat.
Yes. Didn't your dad kind of have a lure for you to do a little better, to aim a little higher?
Yes. He said if I had one semester with nothing less than a C, because you got to understand, I had D's and F's, and a C was a good semester. So for one semester in my entire life, I got A's and B's and, like, you know, maybe a C or something. Mm-hmm. So I got nothing. So I kind of just, I got that Martin 12 string, which is in my studio
and
still.
And this was an expensive, nice
guitar. It's a $500 guitar. And that's still an expensive guitar.
Yeah,
you know?
We're talking about, like, that was one that you knew in order to write songs, this was what you should have.
Well, no, it's just something I wanted. Like, I wanted a 12-string guitar.
Right.
And I wanted a Martin 12-string guitar.
And then you also got a rehearsal space, right?
Well, I got an involuntary rehearsal space. My dad, you know, my parents would hear me. It's like what I do right now. When I'm writing a song, I'm just playing the same thing over and over and just changing it and just kind of, you know, playing around with it. And if you're not me, you probably want to kill yourself. And my parents, you know, did. And they got me a shack in the back of the house.
A shed or something,
a
right?
shed, yeah. yeah. I put a little heater when it was freezing. I would just, I know. It's.
But that was your,
I was happy to go in there.
Yeah.
I would go there and I'd work diligently. I'd go there right after school and I'd sit there till, you know, I went to sleep.
Well, it sounds like even at that early point, let's say 14 years old, you're pumping out 3 songs a day. I was reading.
Something like this.
Maybe
a song a day.
I thought
they were great.
Pretty disciplined. And how though would you say, you know, you weren't somebody who it sounds like had taken music lessons necessarily of any sort. So how did you even know how to construct the song that you were writing?
I think, I mean, I taught myself, I taught myself a little music theory, you know, and I took one class that I kind of paid attention when I wasn't totally stoned, smoking pot on the lawn in high school. There was a great music teacher named Mr. Waddell in my high school. I took one class, and I know a lot of other people that took his class that really learned a lot. I learned a little bit, not much, but I knew chords. I kind of taught myself all that stuff. And, you know, I'm not a great musician, but I can get around. I can write a song. I know, you know, chords and stuff. I can figure it out.
And there was enough promise there that, I mean, what did your parents make of this?
Well, there wasn't promise when my dad took me to a guitar teacher, though, because when I was maybe about 11 or 12, so my dad brought me a little guitar from Tijuana, and I was going to take guitar lessons, and I didn't want to do fucking scales.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I wanted to make up my own songs.
Right.
And I went back the next week, and the guy told my dad, please don't bring your daughter back next week. She has no future in music.
Oh,
she's tone deaf. Wish I remember his name.
That would be great to find out what he's up to now.
Yeah, what are you up to?
But it was just a few years later, by the time, you know, you now had this nicer guitar and you were doing your own thing, it seems like your mother was a little bit skeptical, but your dad believed in you,
right? Yeah, my mom would say things like, that song's really good. Take it to Ralph's and see if they'll give you groceries. But my dad was more of a dreamer.
Yeah.
You know, and he really believed in me, and he would take me to publishers, you know. And
well, explain what that actually looks like, though. So you're in LA.
Here's what it looks like. Here's what it looks like. There's music publishers. So my dad would take me to see one. Here's what one looked like. We had a meeting, and the publisher, who I still know, his name is Rick Shoemaker. Mm-hmm. He's on my Facebook friend still.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad took me to see him, and he really liked the songs we played. And he goes to my dad, you know, you need to go and demo these songs up. And my dad goes, if you think they're so fucking great, why don't you spend your own fucking money?
He's saying that to this guy, to Rick.
Yeah, it was awesome.
That's great. But you're basically beating the pavement for a good decade, essentially, while it was interspersed with a little bit of college here and there.
Yeah, I mean, college for me was, I took up space. When you take up college space?
Yeah.
My dad said if I went to college, he'd help support me.
Okay.
So I went to Pierce Junior College for 2 years.
Okay.
It's funny, there was a songwriting class, you know, not that you can learn songwriting in a class, but a guy named Buddy Kay, a very famous old-time songwriter, taught it, and I became his pet. He loved me. And then from there, I went to Cal State Northridge.
And that's where you were breaking into rooms and stuff.
I was breaking into the practice rooms.
Right. Because
there was piano. Well, I taught myself piano.
Okay.
So I was teaching myself piano, around the Pierce time. Because I read somewhere that a piano is the best songwriting instrument. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, well, I don't know. I'm going to learn. I'm too OCD to take piano lessons. And you know what I mean? I just can't concentrate on it.
Right.
It's funny, certain kind of OCD people can super concentrate, though. So with my songs and stuff, I could spend hours on one line, like literally. And the same thing with piano. So I kind of taught myself just the basics, chords and things like that. And so at Cal State Northridge, they had some really nice pianos, and I would just break into those rooms. And they gave me an award about 5 or 6 years ago, and they gave me a key, because I told them, why are you giving me an award? I just break into your rooms.
Right.
I probably broke the doors and stuff, but they gave me an award and a key, and they go, anytime you can come in.
Come in
thank
practice.
You.
Yeah.
I'm like in a, it was a distinguished alumni. I was like, I wanted to say but don't you know I'm not only a college dropout, but I vandalized your practice
rooms. That's funny. So eventually, though, you dropped out entirely from college. You focused again fully on getting into the business.
Yeah, but I always was. I was always focused on getting the business.
Yeah.
You know, I would go to restaurants and listen to people if they were talking about music. I'd go, oh, I'm a songwriter. What do you do?
One of those. What happened in 1983 where for the first time you're basically employed by Jack White, not to be confused with another
White Stripes, a very German Jack
German
White.
German producer who I guess was working with
Laura Branigan.
Well, but first, though, didn't he have a relationship with Arista, which was Clive Davis, right?
It was Arista Publishing more than Clive.
Oh, okay.
So his publishing company was administered by Arista.
And he's looking for, he has sort of like a team of writers that are working to touch up pieces, you know, songs?
He signed a couple of American writers, and I was one of them. And the first thing he had me do was write lyrics to a Lord, something called Solitaire. So I know that was technically my first, top 10 hit, but I really don't look at it that way because it was but you know what? He did sign me. He was paying me extremely minimally. He got all my publishing. It was, in hindsight, it was a terrible deal. But had he not done that, had he not signed me, and I had nothing going at the time, and had that not happened, a woman named Linda Blum at Arista wouldn't have hooked me up with Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon, you know?
Right, which was your first movie that you did a song for?
Well, I did a song for Ghostbusters before
which
that.
Which song was that?
I can't remember. It was a Laura Branigan song that wasn't a single. And then, you know, after that, you know, through his relationship with Arista Publishing, I did the song for Last Dragon.
Yes. Well, know? Before we get there, though, let's talk about, you know, I understand that you're saying Solitaire was sort of a for-hire assignment as opposed to something you, but this was a French song that needed American English lyrics.
Yeah, basically.
Eventually, so you turn it in, goes to number 7 on the Billboard charts, and the biggest legacy of that in some ways is that because of the fact that you were sort of screwed out of the payment of the royalties or whatever of that song.
Not just that song. I mean,
and well, others with
because he was
Jack.
Yeah, and you know what? I've become friends with him, but at the time we weren't all that friendly. You know, I mean, I'm grateful to him because without, you know, so he wasn't always that nice and stuff. And they were late on some, you know, payments or some accounting. And my lawyer goes, you know, if he does it, if he's late again, you know, we could get out of the contract. I'm like, goody.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I tried to sit down with him because after Rhythm of the Night, I recouped, you know, thousands of times over. So it was like paying me, you know, $250 a week, and I hardly anything to do my demos, and that song was a massive hit. And I go, just give me a little piece of my own publishing. You know, I've earned that, and he wouldn't do it. And then he kept missing accounting periods and stuff, and so I left him, and he sued me, and I was getting all these offers with big publishers to sign there,
right?
Because of the lawsuit with him. And then I remember, and this is the best thing that ever happened to me. My lawyer goes, well, you have to keep your publishing. I go, but I don't want to keep my publishing. I'm being offered like, you know, $1 million from Chapel or whatever company, and they were all coming after me. And then she goes, no, you have to keep it. What kind of, you know, you should come up with a name of a publishing company.
Right.
And I go, well, I got a couple ideas. I said, what about Real Songs, R-E-A-L-S-O-N-G-S? And surprisingly, no one had that, which is, you know, you would have thought a film company would have R-E-E-L or something. But no, I got it.
And so just to explain for somebody who's listening who may not understand, normally if you're writing for another publisher, essentially it's going to usually be like 50-50 split of proceeds.
Yeah, but this wasn't. When my deal with him was he got the publishing.
He got 100%.
Yeah, he got 100%. You know,
so that was terrible.
Yeah. I mean, that was okay to start there where I was, because I was nobody. You know, that's the thing for people to remember. When you're starting, you can't expect everything.
Right.
You know, because I was nobody. I'd never had any success.
But it wasn't even your intention to have 100%. You were happy to do 50-50, but it works out. You probably saved a lot of money. Definitely saved a lot of money by having your own thing because you keep 100%.
I never looked back. And, and when I did that, and actually, I was like smart about it too, because, you know, so it dragged on a bit, and my dad was helping pay the lawyer bills and all that. You know, that shit's expensive.
Yeah.
And I remember we had to go to one court appearance, and I remember seeing him. I thought, you know what? I'm going to shock him. I mean, it's one of the few times in my life I've worn a dress. I didn't know, like, oh, is this, how do you wear these? And I just was very nice. And I was like, hi, Jack, how are you? Very nice, because it was not like, you asshole, you know, none of that. And I said, why don't you and I just get together tomorrow and work this out, and instead of spending all our money on lawyers.
Yeah.
Literally the next day, we worked it out.
Amazing.
It was settled.
But so what happened in the years between Solitaire, which is 83, and 88, which is when Real Songs came along, is that you independently were now pumping out major songs, starting with Rhythm of the Night, which was, as you said, for The Last Dragon, a Berry Gordy movie, performed the song by DeBarge. It went
the
all the way.
The video was done in front of a porn shop. And it didn't look, if you see the video now, it looks really happy and very Disney-ish. But...
Well, the song, though, goes to number 3, and I guess
hit all over the world, too.
Hit all over the world.
Yeah.
And essentially, you were by that point moving towards being your own boss, even though you were still under.
I was always a self-starter, and that was my first words in music song I wrote by myself too. That I had a hit with, so that was really special.
I guess what I'm unclear about is, so the argument with Jack was that after Solitaire, you want to keep doing your own stuff. So like Rhythm of the Night,
no,
on your own.
Yeah. There was no problem with him about me writing my own songs. I wasn't signed to him just to do like lyrics.
So it was only for like touching up or things that he
that
gave you.
That was just
you.
A couple of things that he had
so
me
now
do.
You
so
go
it was still
solo.
Like, it was still just to write songs and he'd own the songs.
So now though, when you're doing your own thing with starting, let's say with Rhythm of the Night and going forward, where does the discipline, for somebody who didn't have much discipline with academics or with other things?
No, Mike, but are you kidding me? No, when I knew what I was doing, I've been this way since I was like 14.
Okay.
Once I, no, this is like, I've been disciplined.
Let's talk about what your day looks like since then. 12 hours a day in the office by
we
your
start
own.
Start out with a coffee bean.
Coffee bean to that. But 12 hours, 6 days a week. You might take off Sunday sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then.
But I'm not sitting there 12 hours a day writing, like full on 12 hours. Yeah. I mean, I go in the morning, I sit at my keyboard, sometimes my guitar. You know, and I morning is my favorite time to write. Mm-hmm. Just I feel fresh that, you know, in the morning. And then I might have a meeting or, you know what I mean? So I'm doing other things too.
But for like 35 years, you've been pumping out on average, what, a song a week?
A song a week. I do the same thing. The weird thing is it's like, I live in a nicer house. Yeah, I drive a nicer car, but I still haven't cleaned my office in 30 years.
You call it the cave, right?
It is. It is. You know who gave it that name was Robert Hilburn.
Oh, yeah?
Of the LA Times. He used to be the head music critic. He dubbed it that. But I do the same thing. I haven't stopped doing what I do. Like, I don't chill out at all. I don't rest on any laurels at all.
You know, some people get writer's block or things like that. It doesn't seem like you do.
No, I can get stuck on a song, but you know, where's your wood? Some in my head. You know, I don't really get a lot of writer's block. I think it's kind of like I keep the machines going. I think if you stop and go, you know, I'm going to take a couple months, then I think it might be hard to gear
back
in.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know how, because to me, it's like breathing.
Right.
And this is what I do.
What for you, though, has tended, maybe it's different once in a while, but generally, what comes first, music or lyrics?
Who's the famous, Sammy Kahn.
Yeah.
He had an answer to that. It's not the same as my answer. Someone asked Sammy Kahn that. He goes, he said the check. It's like a famous story. But for me, it's sometimes it's a title.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's sitting at a keyboard, at my piano or my keyboards or a guitar, playing a chord progression. Lyrics first.
It's never lyrics first.
No, I wouldn't even know how to write a whole lyric and do music.
But
to
is
it.
That totally true? Because I've heard stories that you would be at a restaurant and hear somebody talking about something, and that's a springboarding.
Yes, that's a title, and that's an idea for a song.
Okay,
I wouldn't sit and write a whole lyric and then write music to it. I wouldn't even know how to do that.
Okay.
So I'll hear someone say something, and you know, just go, that's a song title, or you know, or someone, a friend's going through a really hard time, and I go, tell me more. And they're going, no, but you're not even listening to what I'm saying. All you care about is your song. I go, no, I really care about you. Tell me, so what were you feeling?
Right.
And then when I finished it, one of my friend Risa, I was like playing her, like she went through this really horrible breakup, and I was getting all these ideas for the song. So she was in the room. I played it for her, and she started crying. Uh-huh. And I go, oh, great. She goes, it's great that I'm crying. I go, no, the song's working. So, but she was cool. She got
That's funny. So, you know, we've talked about the fact that, I guess, Ghostbusters, Last Dragon. By this point in the mid-80s, you're starting to write songs specifically for movies. And is writing a song for a movie different than writing a song generally? Do you need to see the movie first? Do you need to know where they want to use your song in a movie?
I could just hear the I could see the movie. I could read the script. I could see, you know, I did something recently where the director was just telling me, I didn't even read the script yet, but he was explaining it so beautifully. And I just got the whole picture of it that I wrote a great song from that. You know, from what he told me about it. You know, here's an interesting thing. When I was at Cal State Northridge, I wasn't really a music major. I was almost like a film major because I kept taking all these movie classes. Mm-hmm. You know why? Because I didn't have to do anything but see movies.
Right. But so, you probably, through osmosis.
I always say that. I think by sitting in that back, I'm always in the back so I could like jot things down. I think by osmosis, by seeing that, I think I really did get an education in that.
In film music, I mean, but so if some of your songs are used in a dramatic point in a movie, some of them are end credits. Yeah. When you're working on it, you don't need to know where they want to use it?
No, I just get inspired.
Okay.
You know, and you hope they use it in it, you know, and sometimes they don't use it at the end.
How often do they specifically tell you how they want to use it? Like, hey, we're going to have, I know that certain movies, they'll say like, this is going to be after somebody dies.
It's not
suddenly.
Usually that specific.
It's not.
You know, unless it's just, unless I know it's just going to be the end song or something.
Right.
But then even then you just hope that, well, and I always try to talk to them, can you get it in there too? So can you put it in the score too? You know?
And which does sometimes happen, like Marshall.
And I loved that. And it was so subliminal.
Right.
You know, Marcus Miller did a really beautiful score with that.
Well, so I would like to take a trip down memory lane if we can and go through a lot of these hits or important songs that came along the way. So it's going to go chronologically. So I'll set up each one. Let's start with Nothing's Going to Stop Us Now for Mannequin, the movie in 1987, performed by Jefferson Starship, your first song to reach number one on the Billboard US and UK charts. And the first of these 10 Oscar nominations.
The song from a movie about a guy fucking a mannequin. Yes, that's how my illustrious Oscar nomination start.
First number one.
Yeah.
You composed that one.
But that's basically what the movie's about, right?
Well, sure. And but what's interesting also to me about it is that you have very rarely co-written songs.
Yeah, me and Albert Hammond wrote that. He's a really good friend of mine, dear friend of mine. And he was at my house so I had an all night party waiting for the nominations. It's kind of what I do. Two nights ago, slumber party.
Just the other night.
And he was over, and I was like, Albert, remember the first one? Yeah.
Because you ended up with him co-writing that one.
Yeah.
And I guess though, why is it that by and large, probably 90 something percent of the time, you choose to write independently?
Because that's just what I do. I think my best songs come that way. And I love my process. I like just, sitting there. And then there's a certain point where I walk away and I get out of the song's way.
Right.
So I just prefer it.
It's probably annoying.
I like to follow my
cadence.
Yeah, I don't want to.
And
if it's, and then I don't want to have to talk them into something that I know is right. But he and I had a really, we wrote some really good songs together. And that was my first Oscar. Who knew?
Nomination. Yeah. All right, 1988, Look Away, performed by Chicago, their best-selling single ever, even after the departure of Peter Cetera, number one on the Billboard Hot 100 for 2 weeks, number one for 1989 on the year-end Billboard Hot 100, and it offers a nice case study, I think, in how inspiration can strike you anywhere to come back to this idea. I think it was a restaurant, right, where you heard something?
Well, my friend was going through a divorce, my friend Terry, and I got that. I got that concept. She was like about to tell her husband that she was leaving him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like how it was like killing her. It was like, and I was like, I think I'm getting an idea from you. And then it was one of those things again where I hate to like steal your life from you, but can I use your life for a song?
Well, it worked.
Can I let you inspire me?
Right. Next, you had an insane 1989. We're going to have several that I'm going to bring up here. But let's start with If I Could Turn Back Time, performed by Cher. You and Cher have collaborated on more than 20 songs
than
30 years.
With Prayers for This World last year.
Yeah, for Cries from Cher.
I can't keep track. Yeah.
A couple years. I think probably more frequently than any other.
Yeah, she's her and then Celine Dion after that. But,
right.
But yeah.
But you sometimes, you've said you with her, it's not always like, even with that frequent of collaborations, you sometimes have to fight her to do something. And that was
an example, right?
If I Could Turn Back Time, she didn't want to do.
Hated it. And her A&R guy at the time, John Kalodner, and I kept saying, John, get her to do it. He goes, no, she won't do it. She hates it. She won't do it. And she happened to be at Village Recorders working on her album. And she happened to be doing a song of mine that day, another song. And I went in, she was in the lounge. I was like, just please try the song. Don't even worry about the one that you're doing in the other room. It means nothing. This song will change your life. She goes, I hate it. I go, you got to try it. She goes, I'm not going to try it. And I literally grabbed her leg. And I go, I'm not letting go of your leg. She goes, let go of my fucking leg. I go, I'm not letting go of your fucking leg. She goes, let go of my leg, Diane. I go, I'm not until you say you're going to try it. She goes, I'm not trying. I go, I'll pay for it. She goes, I'll try it.
and then what, she heard it and loved it?
Yeah, and then she started singing it, and I was in there when she was doing the vocal, and she looked at me like, you asshole, you're right. I went like this.
Well,
of course I am.
The numbers certainly.
That's like her iconic song,
yeah,
really.
That's probably the first one you think about.
And what I loved about that lyrically is that, she was dating, the young guy. It's like she's the perfect person. There was no one else for that song
but
Cher.
That is, I guess, an example of a power ballad, which is something that you are very closely associated with. And I guess I want to ask you, if you're the authority, best person I could ask, what is a power ballad and how did they become sort of your thing?
What is a power ballad? A melodic song. It's emotional. I guess that's what it is. I don't think of Turn Back Time as a power ballad, though.
You don't.
I mean, I think of I Don't Want to Miss a Thing as a power ballad.
But the idea of what they are, it's something that, you would go to want to do at karaoke, right?
Oh, yeah, those are all great. I do good karaoke songs.
You do. You definitely.
If I could turn back time. You know what? In one of the Cher songs, she wouldn't come back to the studio. She goes, I'm done. I'm not coming back. Another song called Love and Understanding.
Yeah.
On the second verse, there's a, whoa. And it's me.
Oh, you did.
Yeah.
You were doing Cher?
Yeah, I did. I was Milli Vanilli-ing on her record.
Well, we'll get to them shortly.
Yeah.
Same year, actually. But
wow,
furthermore, continuing along in 89, because this is, I don't think anyone's ever had more hits in a single year.
And they were all songs I did myself.
Well, one of them, yeah. So here, well,
Maybe one.
A couple that I'm going to get to with Bolton where you guys were. But first, oh, yeah. We're Not Making Love Anymore, 1989, again, performed by Barbara Streisand.
Is that that long ago?
Yep. And now Michael Bolton is someone you did do a probably more co-writing with than almost anybody. And that is an example of one. So you guys co-wrote
but
this.
But he also did my songs, which was really cool. Like, he was the biggest artist on the planet at that time.
Or one of them. But
yeah, I mean,
his album. But first, let's do this one where you guys are writing it for Streisand.
Yeah.
Why was Michael Bolton somebody you were willing to write with?
He was my friend. We were working together on his record and stuff. So he asked me to do it.
Thing.
Yeah, and I go, yeah, of course. And you know, and then he ended up doing it. I think with Patti LaBelle.
And that year, you did half the songs on his breakout album. Yeah. One of them that you co-wrote was probably maybe his best known song, "How Can We Be Lovers?"
Oh yeah,
and that was
a fun
one
song.
But the other one was the first one that he ever sang that he didn't write
when
or co-write.
When I'm Back on My Feet Again.
When I'm Back on My Feet Again.
To this day, that is one of my favorite songs I've ever written in my life.
It's a great song, but I know there's a personal reason, right?
There is. And my dad had passed away recently. And I don't know why, but I felt like my dad was writing that through me. And it was, I don't know if it was reincarnation or I don't know what it was. You know, I felt my dad's spirit, right?
And it just poured out.
Yeah, just literally, that song's one of the quickest songs I ever wrote. Literally, words and music was... You know, I mean, I'm not one of those people. I can't stand when people go, yeah, I wrote it. I wrote it in 10 minutes. I mean, I'm not that person. So I'm really way too, you know, perfectionist and stuff,
right.
Especially with lyrics, because that's the hard part. But that song literally came from top to bottom almost as I was writing, and I was crying. I was in tears. And I played it for Michael, and Michael was, like, really emotional, and it made him think of his dad.
Who had also
His dad had died years before.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, I have to do that song. And he's someone that wasn't into doing people's songs. And he came in the studio, and I was playing piano, and he was singing it. And after did the piano track, he went out and sang it, actually. And I saw him, and he was wiping away tears, and it was emotional.
Wow.
And then he goes, I want to re-sing it. And I go, no.
That first one was...
Yeah, I go, like, I kind of threatened, you know, even though I never would have really done it, I'm taking it away if you go back in. I'm not letting you have it if you do it, right? Of course I would have, you know, 15 million records. I'm not going to say no. But you know what? But he listened to me because that, even though it was like maybe a couple things in his performance that weren't perfect, but who wants perfect?
No.
That's what's so boring. Like some of the records you hear, like, I don't want to hear perfect. I want to hear you. I want to hear you hitting some wrong notes. I want to hear, you know, just, I want some human stuff. I want to hear the human quality, you know, I don't want to hear perfection. Perfection's not interesting.
For sure.
And so there was stuff in that wasn't perfect, you know. But
the last two songs from 89 that I want to ask you about, it's amazing that I could say the last two when they're, how many people have this many memorable songs from any year or from a whole career even?
I don't even remember, because I'm so fast forward of what I'm doing next. I did that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, these last two I'm going to ask as a group, because on November 18th, 1989, they made you, or you made them, a part of history where, for the first time, a single songwriter had songs that were simultaneously number one and number two on the U.S. charts. The first one was When I See You Smile, performed by Bad English. The second was Blame It on the Rain, a great pop song performed, allegedly, by Milli Vanilli, the twosome that won.
Can I say one thing?
Well, one second. So they went on to win the Best New Artist Grammy in 1990 and then had to give it back because of the whole thing over that.
They didn't sing it.
They didn't sing it. But what I don't understand is, how did they get a Diane Warren song in the first place? And then how did you not know that it wasn't them?
Oh, I had no idea. Because I brought, there was a group that was holding the song. They were called The Jets.
Mm-hmm.
And after holding it for a year, Blame It on the Rain, they didn't do it. So I went to see Clive Davis in New York. And he goes, I have this group that it's perfect for. And he played me Girl, You Know It's True, which is the cadence is almost like Blame It on the Girl, You Know It's True. And Blame It on the Rain. It's weird. And so I go, oh my God, I brought you the follow-up song. And I don't even know if he knew they didn't do it, because he picked them up from Germany.
Okay.
So I don't think he was actually in the studio. I think when it gave it away, when they were, you know, in concert and went, you know, girl, you know, it's, girl, you know.
It started skipping.
They probably weren't doing that live on purpose.
Right.
So that kind of gave it away. But I want to say one thing.
Yeah.
I did Blame It on the, When I See You Smile, for a group called Bad English, John Waite being the singer. And waking up 2 days ago and finding out I got nominated for All Flight was like the greatest high ever. Mm-hmm. And then a few hours later, I found out that my friend Don Grierson had suddenly passed away. And Don was a brilliant A&R man that worked with that group. And he gave them When I See You Smile. So I'm glad you're bringing it up, because I could give a little shout out to him.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful man, and without him, I wouldn't have had that hit song.
Well, moving beyond this incredible 1989, we come to 1992. There's a song that had a long history before it became a hit that year, and I'll ask you to just talk about it, and that is Don't Turn Around, which became a hit with Ace of Base, but it really went back, right?
It's a kind of a fun story. I did that one with Albert Hammond, too, so we did a few really good songs. So what happened with that song? I first, you know, we wrote and I go, you know what, Albert, let's get it to Tina Turner. So I went to see Tina Turner's manager and I played him the song and, you know, they really liked it. And Brian Adams, who was really hot at the time, produced it. And then they go, well, we're not putting it on the album. I'm like, fuck. She was the hottest thing. I remember sitting like crying. And then they go, well, it'll be on the B-side. Well, you know, B-side nobody's going to ever hear in life. But the guy, his name's Luther Ingram. He did the song, If Loving You Is Wrong, I Don't Want to Be Right. Somehow he put the wrong side of that single on and he heard it and he recorded the song and it went, you know, it wasn't much of a hit. I think it went to like 80, you know, or something on the R&B charts. Somehow a group called Aswad, I wonder why they didn't make it in America with a name like Aswad. I don't know. It just doesn't really sound, I don't know. Hey, that's the new song, Turn It Around by Aswad. But they took it and they were actually a great group. They were a reggae group. Yeah. And so they flipped it because it started its life as a rock ballad. Right. That was a power ballad. They flipped it on its ear and it became this reggae record that became a hit in every country in the world, like number one in the UK, everywhere. You know, and in the middle of that period, Neil Diamond did a version of it. Bonnie Tyler, a lot of people recorded that song. Then Clive Davis, and this wasn't even me, somehow he heard that, you know, the Aswad.
Aswad.
God, that name. He heard that version and he recorded it with Ace of Base.
And then so it became really, a massive hit. You were again. Not that privy to all of these things happening. Once you write it, it goes off and then it's sort of.
Yeah, it's that song just, you know, a lot of times I'm like pushing and, you know, trying to get it. But this one, it's like this, it had this weird life force, like you couldn't keep
That's
it down.
Amazing.
And then now I just got asked to let them use it in the Tina Turner musical. I'm like, that's
what. Which will be on Broadway. Or,
yeah.
Or, yeah.
So cool. It's like full, that song went full. Oh, now you want it back. Okay.
Well, all right. So going into, speaking of Clive, I want to ask you just, how did you get to know him? What makes him special? And also, how did you end up working with his favorite singer, Whitney Houston, on You Were Loved, which was a song on the movie The Preacher's Wife, 1996.
So. Okay, well, I had read Clive's book, his first book, when I was a kid. And, you know, when I was 14, 15 and all that, I made my dad get me a subscription to Billboard. So I would, I studied this. So when I didn't give a shit about school. Mm-hmm. But when I got into music and when I knew this is what, I'm going to learn everything. I'm going to learn who wrote things. I mean, I'll meet people today. I'll tell them everything they wrote, and everything, you know. So I made my dad get me Clive Davis's book. I think it might have been called Inside the Record Business. Mm-hmm. And I read it top to bottom. I'm like, I got to meet Clive Davis. Mm-hmm. So that was like the top of the mountain, right, meeting Clive. So after Rhythm of the Night, I got a chance to meet him, you know, so because Arista Publishing, even though I don't know if I don't know how closely he dealt with the publishing company, but through that, I go, well, can I meet Clive? And so I went to see him and I played him some songs. He didn't like any of them. It's like, wow, buzzkill.
Yeah.
So much for climbing up that mountain. I just got thrown off. But I went to a store and bought, you know, it was like retail therapy and bought this really expensive sweater that I couldn't afford. I go, well, you don't like my songs, but I'm going to buy this sweater. And then, you know, later on, I kept bringing him songs. And then he started really loving what I did. And I started writing a lot of songs for a lot of people. And it's kind of funny because, you know, Whitney was the big artist, but he would never take my songs for Whitney. And he'd be going like, well, I want it for this group, you know. And then I go, oh, God. You know, and then he goes, no, I want it for this group XYZ. Then XYZ, I'd have a big hit.
Right.
He goes, well, it's not right for Whitney. I go, why, Clive? Because I have this new artist, Taylor Dane. But then I did like, you know, a couple songs with her, like Love Will Lead You Back was the number one record.
Right.
So I go, okay, whoever you want and stuff. And then finally with The Preacher's Wife, I got my chance with You Were Loved.
With Whitney, yeah. To you, was she as great as some people speak about her?
Oh, like, my God. She's the best singer of our time.
Really?
Yeah. She's the best singer I ever worked with.
Amazing. And I mean, I guess the ultimate power ballad would probably be I Will Always Love You, right?
But you know what Dolly Parton's version was great, but I'm sure Dolly told me the story. I think that Elvis Presley tried to get.
We just sat her on the podcast and talked about it.
She told me that at a party once.
She wouldn't let him do it because
he wanted
the rights.
She was like crying.
Yeah.
And then it's like, then it paid off when, you know, Whitney
so
did
much,
it.
Many times
it's a
over.
Terrible thing when artists try to do that, by the way. It's just, you know.
Because it was the last minute. They didn't tell her until the very last minute. There are a lot of stories like this throughout the music business when you go back and watch
Morris Levy, you know, where he put his name on as a songwriter. Like, it's like, come on.
I'm trying to remember this great producer who died young. There was just a documentary.
Burt Burns. Yeah,
I'm dying to see that. I never saw that documentary.
Yeah, it's really good.
He wrote great songs.
Yeah, but
don't tell me he didn't write the songs.
No, he did. But then he was getting screwed around. Like,
but
it basically
Morris Levy or somebody like
there's
that.
There's this underbelly of the music industry that almost operates, and I think it's always been there.
Yeah, but it's like more overt. It's more overt now, where producers are, you know, someone will come in. What's the writing? What's our writing split? So it's like, wait, I wrote it. It's more overt and out there.
Do you think they just try it to see if it'll work? They might as well give it a go.
I think that, well, the excuse that, and I feel bad for, because it doesn't happen to me a lot, you know, usually they have more respect than to do
at
that.
At this point, yeah.
But it does happen to new writers, and it's like, and the excuse will be like, well, you know, records aren't selling, you know, like they used to. I go, well, does that mean you're going to steal someone else's credit or their publishing or their, and that's not cool.
It's hard to probably make a living when you're splitting it seven ways or something, right?
When you see there's like, you know, 18 writers on a song.
There's not many people are going to have as many hits in a career as you.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, let's go on to the next one. Right. Also 96, Reach, performed by Gloria Estefan, the official song of the Olympics that year. So I guess that was the first time working with her?
Well, I think she had done songs of mine before that.
Okay.
And then, you know, I knew that she had a chance to do the Olympics. And I go, let's write the song. We're really good friends. She's one of my really good friends, actually. She's funny. She's great.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you've done a podcast.
Broadway musical.
Wasn't that awesome?
Yeah, it's pretty
cool. About this is me, like, going, I think one of those songs, it was during Reach, too. I go, I think that's my song. I said to my friend, but until the chorus, I wasn't even sure. I forget everything.
They all blur. Well, you know, I mean, at some point, somebody's going to do a Diane Warren jukebox musical.
I know.
Because
there's plenty of options.
Of
that. Yeah.
Oh, have you ever talked about it?
I mean, I'm talking to somebody right now.
That's awesome. That would be amazing. All right. Well, so, also 96, believe it or not, Unbreak My Heart, Toni Braxton, another one, I guess, where the artist did not want to do this.
No, she hated it. it's just like, wait, how do you, sorry, I mean, how do you hate that? How do you actually, and then, okay, she didn't like it in the first place and didn't want to do it. But then when she did it, and she's like sang the shit out of it, and like, I remember being in the studio going like, I told her, you're getting a Grammy for this. And she did. I guess after she recorded, she still didn't want to do it. I think Clive's like, okay, you want your record to come out? Or do you not want your record to come out?
Because Clive was on your side here.
Yeah, well, he knew.
Yeah.
I mean, how
it just
do you...
shows you can't even sometimes hear your own thing objectively if she didn't
think
that was good.
Wait, and this is the best part. Fast forward a couple of years later, she calls me. She goes, I'd love another song from you. Don't give me another Unbreak My Heart.
What?
Really? I'm like...
Yeah, that didn't work out for you?
What? Okay. Yeah, all right. I mean, it's like I couldn't even say anything to that. I don't know.
So you are one of the great writers of songs about love. And yet, you have talked about openly.
Yeah.
So I'm not breaking any news here.
No.
You've said you were never in love.
No, not like most people are. No. I mean, I love my cat.
But
I really
how
do.
Does somebody
I love
who
music. I love my friends.
Been romantically in love, right? About romantic love,
because I
so
feel
well.
It, because I feel it. I say it's method songwriting. It is, you know, like how
but
does
method
an actor
you draw from your experiences?
Oh, you could draw from you just feel it. I don't even know how to explain it. I do when I'm writing something. I'm believing it. I really am. I don't want to hear someone breathe all night. You
from,
know,
I don't want to miss a thing. We're coming to that one. Yeah. Well, just
but I want to hear my cat purr all night. I love hearing them. It helps me sleep.
But just so this should sink in for people, for somebody who never experienced love. In that sort, in 1 year, Unbreak My Heart, and then we're coming to the next one, which is Oscar nom number two, Because You Loved Me, for the movie
one?
Up Close and Personal, performed by Celine Dion, who you've also done a lot with, as we were saying earlier. These are great love songs, and it's just
amazing. Because You Loved Me, you can interpret it any way you want, because to me, when I was writing, I was almost thanking my dad for believing in me.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing it for the movie and for what Michelle Pfeiffer's character is saying to Robert Redford's character. By the way, that's almost a Me Too movie now, because he was also a mentor to her, to her Robert Redford's character, after he was killed, and I wanted to write something where she was thanking him for believing in her, right? So it wasn't a love song per se. Like, I thought of my dad believing in me, so I'm everything I am because you love me, because you believed in me. So that's what that song was. And then here's the irony. It's become one of the biggest wedding songs. And here's the kind of thing that's always kind of amused me about it. And I mean, not in a bad way, but it's ED. Because You Loved.
Oh, Because You Loved Me.
And you're getting married to it. Like, do they still love you?
Oh, right. I see what you're saying.
But no, I mean, it's still a good wedding song.
Interesting. When you're writing something, though, you seem to be able to do something that other people can't always do, which is know if it's really working or not. And in this case, you've said you realized that your work had gone to another level.
With that song.
With that song.
It did. I felt like I took a giant leap in my craft with that song at that time. It's almost like that song was better than me. I did something recently, too, that I feel like that. That's me in a year or something. Like I touched something. Like with that song, there was something craft-wise or something that was better than, that was the best thing I'd ever done.
Wow. Well, you get the second Oscar nomination, and you've said that of the nine prior to now, that was the one you went into feeling maybe the
like,
most.
Like, I'm winning this. I know I'm winning this.
You brought
this.
Clive as your
Clive
date.
Clive came, and I didn't. And it was like, Because You Loved Me didn't win, but You Must Love Me won. And I remember Tim Rice calling me and saying, you should have won.
Because like, it was Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber winning for this song from Evita.
And I remember me and Clive, we went to Jerry's Deli, and I ate two orders of French fries that night.
Cover yourself.
Just because, like, just drown my sorrows
in
French fries.
A listener should know you're a very, very skinny person, so that must have been a major thing. But,
yeah.
All right, well, this brings
I wasn't skinny
us...
after that night.
All right, this brings us to...
Well, there were two times I thought, okay, that's the first time I thought I had a chance.
Okay, well, we're going to go through them all. Number three Oscar nom, How Do I Live, is a song that you wrote for Con Air in 1997, the first of several songs you've done for Jerry Bruckheimer Films. This one was performed by Leanne Rimes, who at the time was a 14-year-old country singer, but would now become a pop star because of this. And I don't think I realized until I started prepping for this just how big of a hit the song was. So I'm going to just go over for
the
listeners.
The biggest selling
theme. Hold on.
Sorry.
It stayed on the Billboard Hot 100 chart for 69 weeks, setting a new record that wasn't broken until Jason Mraz's I'm Yours 11 years later. It was in the Billboard Hot 100 chart's top 10 for 32 consecutive weeks, setting a new record that wasn't broken until Ed Sheeran's The Shape of You came along 20 years later. And it was in the Billboard Hot 100 chart's top 40 for 62 consecutive weeks, a record it still holds. It was certified 3 times platinum, unprecedented for a country single, and unsurpassed until Taylor Swift's Love Story 12 years later. And eventually it was named by Billboard as the most successful song of the 1990s. It is still the number 4 song on Billboard's all-time top 100 chart, behind only Bobby Darin's cover of Mack the Knife, Santana's Smooth, and Chubby Checker's version of The Twist. That is insane.
There's one more thing. It's the biggest female record of all time
of
in
all
Billboard.
Time, yeah, if it's, yeah, that's right.
Because, the number one.
So how did it come about?
Well, I wrote the song for Con Air. I was one of 150 people that wrote songs for that. Played for Jerry. He loved it. I ran into Leanne Rimes at a restaurant.
A 14-year-old girl?
Yeah.
Oh, she
was with her dad and her manager. And she had just won the Billboard Best New Artist Award as well. And I said, hey, I wrote the song for Con Air. Would you want to hear it and work it up? And she goes, yeah. And so she came to my studio. We did that song. We did a couple other songs. She loved it. Now she's, okay, now keep in mind that they thought it's the song for the movie.
Right.
It wasn't the song for the
Not
movie
chosen yet.
Yet. No.
Yeah.
Well, they went back to Nashville and spent about $100,000 on it. They did a whole video.
Who's they?
Leanne's
her
producer
her
and
folks,
her
yeah.
dad co-produced the song. You know, $100,000 video, beautiful video, string, orchestra, the whole thing, right? And they send it back, and it's great. And I played it for Jerry, and Jerry, of course, is excited because she is the hot thing.
Yeah.
So I play it, and he goes, you know, I love it, but I want him to change a couple of things. Wilbur, her dad, right? I said, Wilbur, just for the movie, because you'll have your record. And so she goes, he goes, literally, to him, I ain't changing nothing for them Hollywood people. I go, wait, but listen, you're not changing anything. You still have your record. You're going to release your record.
Right.
It's just, we do this all the time. It has to fit the scene.
Yeah.
You know, you might just have to change a little bit. I ain't doing nothing. I'm like, oh, God. And then so Jerry goes, okay, well, I can't use her version. Would you mind if Trisha Yearwood did it? I go, yeah, but I can't pull Leanne Rimes. I mean,
right.
I can't do it. And A, I couldn't do it. That wouldn't be the right thing to. B, she was the hottest thing in music.
Yeah.
Why would I want to?
Right.
So Trisha does it for the movie. And I go, as long as I can have Leanne do it. So he goes, fine, that's fine. Then he calls me after Trisha does it. And he goes, you have to pull Leanne's version. And then he told me after Trisha Yearwood would end
because
up recording.
Because Trisha wanted exclusively.
Yeah, because we can't have two versions. I go, I can't do that. And he's like, you're never going to work at Disney. You will never work with me. And I was like crying on the phone, like, oh no, I'm so scared. And then when he went, a year later, I did Aerosmith. Okay. Well, but I was so scared and I couldn't. Everybody was pissed at me. Like, everybody wasn't talking to me. He was mad. He wasn't talking to me. And then Leanne found out about Trisha, and she hated me, and they'd spent all this money. And I called Mike Curb at the time. She was signed to Curb Records, and he's great. And I go, look, you still should release this because Trisha will only be, it'll be great, just country, but Leanne's not just a country artist. She's like, this will make her a pop star.
Mm-hmm.
And he listened to me.
And so which one is in the same movie time. Then?
Trisha Yearwood's is in the movie. The weird thing is Leanne sang it on the Grammys and then Trisha won a Grammy for it for the country vocal. Some weird thing like that, as I recall. God. But in the movie, so Trisha is one who sang it on the Grammy, on the Oscars.
Because she did it in the movie. The nominated version,
but yeah. Leanne's version was giant. And Trisha's too. Like Trisha, it was like a number one country record for, it's probably Trisha's biggest hit.
So all these stats that Leanne's, I just cited, whose version is that we're referring to?
Well, there's two versions. So the version that you hear in Con Air is only Trisha Yearwood's.
Right.
But on the radio that you'd heard on pop radio, you still hear this day, will be Leanne's version.
Because Trisha's cannot, they're not going to.
Well, Trisha's a country artist, so you'll hear Trisha's on country radio, right?
Right, but the combined totals of them are what we're talking about for
ridiculous.
The.
Ridiculous. Well, not in Billboard. What they're talking about there is only Leanne Rimes. That's what's so cool. That's why that's such a, it's probably my biggest hit I ever had.
So if they counted both Leanne and Trisha's, it would be even bigger.
I think that sold like 20 million singles with Leanne. I mean, it's not even
why
just
do you think it struck such a chord with listeners?
When I wrote it, I thought it was really a special song. I mean, you never know what's going to really connect. It was really used well in the movie. You know, it was an emotional scene.
And do you remember, had you been, in this case, told, this is the scene where we want a song, or was it
Yeah, that was, he was showing the scene and stuff.
Okay.
And the cool thing is they both literally came out at the same time, and they took these different, Trisha went to number one country. She had a greatest hits album that sold 5 million albums.
Yeah.
And then around the world, in Australia was the biggest record that year. And then Leanne's version would be in, you know, the number one record in the UK. They both had, you know, enormous hits with that song.
And did they come away from this friendly towards each other or towards you, or
well,
what? How did it all?
They
end?
Were all cool with me.
Yeah.
I mean, I was one that everybody hated, but then they loved me.
Then they came around
because they loved me.
Yeah,
they didn't know how to live without
but
me.
And the two of them don't mind. I guess they didn't deliberately do anything to each other.
No. Yeah. But you know what's really cool? All these mixers would mix it, would cut in the same key, so there would be versions that were
half of each.
Yeah, it was
oh
awesome. And then it became a dance record too, which was really awesome.
When you have a song coming together and it's not yet where it needs to be, or let's say right now, if something triggered something in your mind that you'd want to remember for the beginning of a song, do you write down something or do you record something, or what's your way of?
I still have a BlackBerry, and I usually would just type a title or something onto it because I use that to write with.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to get it charged. Battery's dead. Or if I'll sing it into my voicemail. I mean, I got to learn how to use the thing on my Samsung. I know there's a way to record
to
on
record
there.
To record audio, yeah.
You know, but I'm always afraid, like, I'm going to push something and it's going to erase.
And lose it.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's why I still use a Walkman and cassettes. I do.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Because you can just...
I take. They're there.
You
they're
can
physically
see if it's
there.
Working.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and it's not going to go away.
Ugh.
That's funny. All right, so a year after that, Oscar nom number four was for 1998's I Don't Want to Miss a Thing for the movie Armageddon,
yeah,
performed by Steven Tyler.
That's after Jerry Bruckheimer said, I'll never work with you.
Yeah, so Jerry came
yeah,
probably
he
crawling
worked
back.
With me again.
Yes, and this one, another huge one. I exactly remember where I was seeing this movie with my summer camp. We got
oh,
a
great.
Day off to go see
Way
this.
To make me feel old.
No, come on. It was yeah. It was the coolest thing. It was like this big,
did you go to
huge
a summer
movie.
Camp too?
Not that year, but
I did.
It was the big movie of the summer.
Yeah.
And this is the song that everybody was singing. And the weirdest part of all, from what I gather, is that it started, the kernel of the idea is owed to James Brolin.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what's crazy? Like, it was an interview saying how he'd miss her if he'd go to sleep. And my cousin told me about it.
Wait. So he's saying about Barbara
yeah,
Streisand, his wife.
He's going to miss her when he goes to sleep. And my cousin told me about the interview. And I go, God, that's such a good idea for a song. So I wrote down the title. I don't want to miss a thing. I didn't even actually see this interview until about a year ago.
Really? So
yeah.
You just heard secondhand?
I'd heard about it and then I finally saw it.
And you thought it was charming or just a good idea?
I thought it was a great song idea.
Yeah. And so now...
Even though I don't want to stay awake and hear someone breathe, doesn't mean someone else doesn't. Steven Tyler singing that, which was so cool when
well,
I wrote
well,
it.
Let's, okay. let's, let, no, only
all
because
right.
I think it's important. How does Steven Tyler enter the picture? His daughter is Liv Tyler.
Yeah,
she's
in the movie.
Starring in the movie.
Yeah.
He goes to see, what, an early cut of the movie.
Yeah.
And her dad is Bruce Willis.
Now, I'll give all credit to this to
yeah.
my friend Kathy Nelson, who
okay.
I did a lot of these Disney movies with. We did Con Air. We did Armageddon.
She's head of music.
She was head of music at Disney
okay.
at the time. Now, Kathy has this way with artists where she said, I'm going to get Aerosmith to do it. I go, no way. Steven Tyler's not going to do my song. You
because
know?
Why?
Because they write their own songs, and it would be like,
and
at
they're
the time,
more like rocking
they're more
out.
A rock group.
Yeah.
So doing a song with, you know, me, you know, that makes pop sell out. I don't know. You know, at that time. And she goes, no, I'm going to get him to do it. And then, you know, she called me. She goes, Steven loves it and he wants to do it.
But wow. Part for him, the thing was, he's watching an early cut of the movie, seeing his daughter watch her father, quote unquote, Bruce Willis, die. Yeah. Maybe he's thinking a little bit of himself.
Yeah, I think that's how Kathy got him involved. And it really was emotional for him, that scene. And then he loved my song. And I remember just sitting, you know, with Sunset Marquee.
Yeah.
And sitting on the piano with him and teaching him the song. And I was crying just as I'm playing. And he's just singing and just... Because, at the time I wrote it, I thought it would be like a woman singing like a Celine Dion or something like that. But what's so cool about the song is when Stephen does it, I love the vulnerability in the lyric with this manly man.
Right.
So it's just such a great dichotomy that works.
So good.
Because these girls would love it, their husbands don't say that to them and their boyfriends don't say that to them.
Right. I've put together this week, I had all these singles, but I didn't necessarily realize that all of them were written by Diane Warren. So I've made a Diane Warren playlist.
And
it's been fun going through and listening to just on a loop all these. But that one I think might be just my personal favorite. And my sense from things you've said is that the arrangement is the one that you're the happiest with. Basically, when you turn over your song to an artist.
That was a perfect. And I remember a lot of times I'll be in the studio when someone's recording something or I'll hear part of it. I didn't hear a note of it, and it got sent to me, CDs. Kids, there were something called CDs.
Yes.
They're kind of like 45s. They went the way of the dinosaur. But I love records. I love physically holding things and looking at credits as opposed to, finding the wrong credits online. Don't get me started. But I remember hearing that and just literally from that orchestral opening, that literally it just knocked my socks off. Just hearing... that beautiful intro and then changes keys and Steven Tyler. It's just best record ever.
Just a year later, it's unbelievable.
That should have got record of the year. That really should have.
I don't remember. Do you remember what it lost to?
Yeah, I always lose to something. I don't remember what it was that year.
Right. Well,
it's a theme.
Next year, it's going to change. But the next year was Oscar nom number 5. And it's just, I hope listeners are processing. I'm not saying 5 years later or whatever. Every year there's something unbelievable. So the next year is the song Music of My Heart for the movie Music of the Heart.
Yeah, they changed the title of that movie. It was called 70 Violins or something.
Okay, so there's similar titles here for the song and the movie. Performed by Gloria Estefan and featuring...
NSYNC.
NSYNC.
Basically a duet with NSYNC were the hottest group on the planet at that time.
And the context is essentially that you've got students thanking their great music teacher. And for you, again, it's not necessarily a direct parallel when you're writing it, but you're thinking about somebody that...
I was thinking of a really kind camp counselor when I went to my Jewish summer camp, Camp Scottmar. It was in Agora Hills in the valley.
Oh, yeah.
And her name's Renee, and she was great. She was really one of the nicer adults, even though she wasn't really, she's only 4 years older than me or something. It's something that was someone that was really kind to me and reached out to me, when I was this angry kind of teenager. I was thinking of her writing the song. So I was thinking, I want to write a song kind of thanking somebody that was encouraging me and good to me. And one of the really great things I got to do was after I wrote it, we'd reconnected.
Oh.
And I said, I want to play you something. And I said, I thought of you when I was writing this, and she was crying. It was just really beautiful to see that.
Yeah, you can't really give a more lovely gift than something that came right from the heart. All right, so 2 years later, you get Oscar nomination number 6 in 2001. This is There You'll Be for the movie Pearl Harbor. And it's another song for a Jerry Bruckheimer movie. And I understand you were
kind
of...
See, he did work with me again.
Yeah, I think I'm sure his movies would be a lot lesser without you. But this one is There You'll Be. The song was performed by Faith Hill, who you had in mind from the start.
I thought she'd be... Just even her name. It was Pearl Harbor. It was her name just sounds... very America, didn't it? And she's a great singer, and he kind of put me through the ringer having me rewrite that song 20 times and stuff. But it was one of the last songs. I remember my mom loved that song. I remember that.
That's a great one, yeah.
She didn't say, take it to Ralph's by Grossman.
Well, she eventually basically got on board, right?
The whole... Yeah, but I'd say something. My mom was my mom, she was just funny. I'd say, Mom, I got this great deal. And I'd say a staggering amount of money, and she'd go, well, how much are you going to keep?
What does that mean? How much are you going to keep?
After taxes.
Oh,
she's
she's
skeptical. It's like, oh, God, can't you just say, that's really good?
That's the Jewish mother.
Yeah, it is, man. But I had to prove to my mom, I always say that's even more than, in a way, than my dad encouraging me. Because I still have
it. Because it drove you to prove something, right?
I still have it in me. I still have, really? You don't think I can do that? Fucking watch me.
That's so funny. Well, just a quick aside. I went to Brandeis University, and there was a professor there, Joyce Antler, who wrote a book that I will never forget. I think the title is... You Never Write, You Never Call, A History of the Jewish Mother.
I heard of that. Did you say, oh dear? Did you get it? Antler. I know. That was really stupid. Sorry. No, that's... I know, it was dumb. I heard of that book.
It's pretty funny. It's, you know, I bought it. All right, so...
You didn't get it for free?
No. Come on. Got to support your struggling professors.
That's here. Right.
All right, 2002... Can't Fight the Moonlight for Coyote Ugly, performed again by Leanne Rimes. So she couldn't have been too upset with you.
No, they all like you again after they have a hit with you. They hate you, and like then they go like, it's like,
please make me another hit.
Yeah, I like you now. Give me another song. You know, I did all the songs. That's the one movie I did. You know, I did
the
four.
Whole soundtrack.
Yeah, I did the whole soundtrack. Like, well, I did four songs, which forms the whole. But the score is the soundtrack. All the musical score is based on my songs too.
But in fact, in this case, the song that would go with the last scene was actually, up until very, very late in the game, going to be a different song.
Yeah, and I had this feeling it wasn't working when I saw like a rough cut. I didn't want to say anything then because I didn't want to like knock my own song out. But then I guess it really wasn't working. I literally had 3 days to write a song and I just quickly did that song.
And they were amenable to hearing something else.
Yeah, and they loved it.
Oh, I'm sure when they heard that one.
I mean, it's a good song. Thank you. And I remember, I think they had to like put it, like it was before you could digitally do everything.
Right.
They did some kind of thing where the movie was almost in a theater and they got it in there. You know.
And that was, another big hit.
Huge. That's my biggest hit outside of America. That's all.
Really?
Yeah.
Can't Fight the Moonlight? Why would that be? Any rhyme
I don't
reason?
Know. It was like the biggest hit in a lot of countries that year.
I guess I never realized,
and you know that,
even though I grew
someone
up.
Someone needs to do Coyote Ugly 2. All the people want to do it because I've been in touch with them.
Yeah.
Coyote Ugly 2, called Can't Fight the Moonlight.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and Coyote Ugly the musical.
On Broadway.
Yeah. It would be fun.
Why not? I mean, who's got, this must
I don't
be
know.
A rights issue.
I
talk
don't
to
know.
Talk to, is that who's, that's not
that's
Jerry.
Jerry.
Is it
I mean,
Jerry?
I think he has part of that. I don't know.
Well,
someone else has to do
that. That would be cool to do. I guess I just honestly, even though I grew up with all this music, I didn't realize that Leanne Rimes was so huge.
Yeah.
What's she up to these days? Is she still
She's still making music and stuff. You know, she needs to...
She needs you.
Yeah, I mean, I would work with her again. She just needs to be surrounded by the right team and have a really good label situation where someone will really get behind her.
Right. And she's still got to be so young. If she was 14...
Well, she's 34 now, which is really weird because that makes me feel really old.
Yeah, but I mean, that's...
She's still young.
So young, yeah.
Yeah. And she's still... By the way, she's still a great singer. Great singer. One of the best singers I ever worked with is Leanne Rimes.
2010, flashing forward just a little bit here. Well, first, let's say Coyote Ugly is 2002. Turn of the century, it seems like there was a little bit of a shift in in the industry's taste in music and whatever. And to some extent, it seemed to become more about rap and hip hop and all that stuff. Did you feel that where you're doing
songs,
ballads and anthems and
I do
of,
other things too. Like I still would work with a lot of different people.
No, I know you can do everything, but I'm just wondering, was it palpable that there was a bit of a shift that you then had to acclimate towards?
Yeah. And then there was a lot of the grunge stuff.
Yeah.
But I've always I don't chase trends because I think if you just do what you do, and I do a lot of different kind of things, but it kind of comes back as if you're chasing trends, you're always going to be late.
So 2010, you haven't seen The Last of Me for Burlesque, performed again by Cher, your old pal. This was a hugely well-received song to the extent that it was getting all kinds of awards buzz. And I hope I am not out of line to bring up a sensitive topic, but it was in the course of that season that you lost someone who was very close to you and Jeff, your longtime publicist, who's so great, and he was here. And that's, your beloved publicist, Ronnie Chase. And this was November 16th, 2010. And then you win the Golden Globe and you thanked her very movingly, dedicating it to her. And I guess I just wonder if we did this when Hans Zimmer was on the podcast. I think, it's important for people who don't know a person to remember, that it's a chance to learn about them and not forget that this person.
None of those people, Hans wouldn't have been on those stages.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been on that. Anybody that Ronnie was great. These are people that do all the work, like Jeff, Jeff over there.
Yeah. And you basically, though, for years worked with her, right?
Yeah.
And what is somebody like that, how do they help a career? How do they...
Because you have to build awareness and know how to navigate all that. We don't. We're musicians. We're songwriters. So somebody that's brilliant like that, you can't really do it without them.
The next year, you worked with somebody who has sort of become, along with Taylor Swift and Rihanna, maybe the most popular music artist of the second decade of the 21st century, and that is Beyonce. You did a song for her fourth album, I think a song that actually was sort of in the works as far back as 9/11, called I Was Here.
Well, no, I didn't write that. What it was I called Jay-Z to play for him and he wasn't calling me back. And someone I worked with in my office, Batman, actually, she at the time was my sister. Now she's more important there. She called Jay-Z and said, it's about 9/11. So he took my call. He got on the phone with me and I said, you know, I'm going to play you something.
And did you know him before this?
I'd met him a couple of times. Okay. I didn't know him, really. So I played on my acoustic guitar. Yeah. I wrote it on the guitar. And he goes, you said something like, you know, you just wrote my, you said in one song what I've been trying to say all my life. Wow. And Beyonce has to do the song, just stay by your phone. Her plane's landing in a half hour. This is a Monday. This is, I think, the last day of Oprah's show, because I think she was flying there.
Oh, okay.
You know, I played the song on the phone. I'm not going to hype you. I'm just going to play it. She goes, okay, my album was supposed to be mastered and mixed. Mastered. It was already mixed by Friday, turning it in. So she goes, I'm cutting the song on Wednesday.
Wow, that quick.
And
turn.
That quick, and came in. And there's a funny, there's a really good, another funny story with that song. So at the same time, I thought it was really good for Beyonce. I thought I wanted to send it. I'm friendly with Simon Cowell. I thought, you know what? I think it's great for Leona Lewis or Susan Boyle or somebody like that, because it's a pretty open song. It's really, it's one of my, I think that's one of my best songs. Mm-hmm. So I sent him my guitar vocal version. So that night, I'm in the studio with Beyonce hearing one of the best performers I've ever heard in my life. I mean, literally, she starts out, she nails the song on, you know, she's in there 3 hours. I'm like, oh, you got it already. She goes, no. I mean, and then she goes, we'll eat dinner now. And then I go, okay, great. She goes, I'm going back in the studio to do more. I go, that's, by the way, that's the work ethic.
Yeah.
That's why people like her, people like Gaga are around forever. Because she, after dinner, she goes, no, I'm going to do it better. I thought she was great the first 5 minutes. Don't ask me. And so now keep in mind, I gave that song to Simon Cowell. I get an email in the morning from someone in his office going, Simon sent this for me to listen to. It's okay. It doesn't go all the way for me. If you have more, something else, send it. And it was my favorite email I ever wrote back. That's okay. I was in the studio last night with the biggest artist on the planet. Funny enough, it went all the way for her. Smiley face. Send.
One other person you worked with in 2011 was a very young, but maybe even bigger star in the music scene at that point, who was just kind of hitting the scene, and that is one Justin Bieber, who was probably, what, like 12 or something at the time.
He was a kid,
And the song that you guys ended up doing was Born to Be Somebody, which was part of the movie tie-in album, Never Say Never, the remixes.
It was the end song of that,
The end song. I just wonder what your impression of this guy was. Like, is he actually a very talented guy?
Yeah. I think he's super talented.
Okay.
So here's a funny little story, though. So remember I did You Haven't Seen the Last of Me, and Born to Be Somebody. So they both got nominated for Grammys that year for a song written for a movie. And the age difference between Cher and Justin Bieber was like almost 50 years.
Yeah, probably.
I was like, wow. I just thought that was kind of cool. So yeah, right for everybody.
That's, so you're saying they were both
they're both nominated.
Together.
Yes.
Oh my God.
So it's like,
well, you cover the spectrum.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So, but at that, you know, there people
could have gone out with him. Sorry.
Yeah, that's the way that
she was. Sorry, a
she
few
does
more
like
years.
The younger men, yes. But I mean, I guess I'm just really curious, because he's one of the first examples of somebody who, I guess, like, as you get older, you don't get the music that younger you do.
Right,
but
right.
A lot of people don't get, like, why do younger people love this guy or love this person?
I think he's talented. I think
you do.
Yeah.
Has the celebrity, you know, around him, the insanity, do you think you can survive that when you start that young?
It must be really hard to like, think about how hard that is. You have everybody around you, whether it's him or any other star like that. Everybody is on your paycheck. You know, how much you're going to say to them. I mean, you're lucky if you have somebody honest that's going to say, hey, you know what? You better stop doing this, or you're going to really get in serious trouble or whatever. Because they could just go, all right, you're fired.
Right.
And all the sycophants can come in, you know. And I genuinely feel bad because I see, not necessarily, you know, Justin, but I've been around other artists through my career, and I see it. And I just, like, part of me feels pity for them. No one's really there. And by the way, I'm always honest with people.
But part of the problem was, like, with somebody like Whitney, that wasn't happening, right? You've seen a lot of
I've seen a
like
lot of
that.
Yeah. But then that might be another scenario where you can only do so much. You can put someone in rehab 10 times, and if they're not going to get better, they're not going to, you know what I mean? Because some of it's up to themselves, but you can't enable them. But Whitney, that voice was silenced.
Yeah. Terrible.
Yeah.
All right. 4 nominations in the last 5 years is incredible. Number 7, 8, 9, and 10, I want to cover. The first one we're talking about is Grateful from Beyond the Light, for the movie Beyond the Lights, performed by Rita Ora. 13 years after Oscar nomination number 6. Here's Oscar nomination number 7.
Now, can I tell you a funny story? This has to do with you. No, for real. So I did the song for the movie, Rita Ora. It was the director's choice. I had other ideas, you know. There was no support from the artist or her label, to be honest. Wow. Which is, I don't know. All she did was tweet about it once. I'm like, wait, but why are you working the song? It's a hit song, you know. Right. It's like, oh, God. And so you had your Feinberg forecast, and it was in there. Yeah. Grateful was in there. I think it was number 5 or something. For real, I swear to God. You were projecting nominations.
Right.
And there was no one else projecting that. Like, nothing had happened with that song, really. So I don't know, like, I was like, wow, you had your ear to the ground on that. And then it got nominated.
And I didn't pay you to say this,
no,
right?
No, I swear to God. I swear to God. Remember, Jeff?
Well, I appreciate you saying that.
For real, I swear to God. This
for real. I appreciate it. And it was a beautiful song about self-empowerment.
Yeah, basically it was a hit record.
Yeah, and it's looking at somebody, it's I guess, essentially
be grateful for all the things that messed you up and that fucked you up. You're going, you know what?
So it's like
thank you.
If somebody like Justin Bieber woke up tomorrow and said, Jesus, look what I got into, I want out of this scene of celebrity and music, whatever. Right. I just want to be a normal person, but I'm still grateful for what I've learned from it. That's essentially what the song is.
Yeah, it's grateful for anything that, even things you don't know, things that you're going through at the time that are really hard and or impossible or really challenging. And you're going, you know what, had I not gone through that, and I could relate to that in my life with things, you know, that maybe were uncomfortable, but hey, you know what I learned from that?
Now we come to the trilogy of the ones, 3 of them in the last 4 years, that could be thematically grouped because they're all about real world issues and real world applicability. The first one is Till It Happens to You for the documentary The Hunting Ground, which is about sexual assault on college campuses, performed in the film by Lady Gaga, I guess the as I remember the end credits.
Yeah. And it was and in the movie as well, there's a little
snippet. How does a documentary, low budget essentially documentary, pre-Me Too, we should say, and pre
that song helped Me Too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Nobody was really talking about Cosby was the one thing that we were aware of. But and I remember because we had you and Gaga on the podcast when it was new. You were one of the first episodes, and you guys were both incredibly open about what drew you to this, personal experiences that you'd both had, but it was not like everybody was talking about it yet.
No, and that song, people say that really helped kind of kick in the Me Too movement, because I think music is such a powerful force. I always say that, like, it's powerful because it goes right to your heart. Like, you can't think about it. So music moves you. That song was in a movie, you know, that came and went in a weekend, The Hunting Ground, in February or something.
Right.
And at the time, honestly, the label didn't want that song to come out because Gaga didn't have an album coming, and she was, I think, on, I forgot that TV show. American Horror Story, one of those.
Oh, right.
You
coming
know,
up soon, yeah.
She was working on that. And nobody wanted that record to come out except me.
So they didn't want it to come. The song is in the movie. That's going to happen whether they like it or not. But you're saying they would have rather held the single.
They would have rather like it
for
kind of,
it did album, it, or let it go away.
No, they wanted it to. It was in the movie and then nothing's going to happen. It's like, you know, it's nice and it's in the movie. I knew what that song was. I was in the studio with her. I saw her amazing vocal and heard that how great she produced it.
And you knew her before that?
Yeah, I'd met her a couple times. And when I called her to play her the song, I had just heard she had been sexually. She talked about Howard Stern.
Yeah.
And I go, I'm going to take a chance here. And so I called her. I played on the piano and I got back on the phone. She was crying.
Wow.
And she goes, I want to do this, but I've talked to my manager and I'll let you know tomorrow. So I go, I'm going on a plane. She was in New York. And I literally landed. It's either going to be yes or no. And it was a yes.
So you went to New York to have a face-to-face with her.
And just go over the song and go over arrangements and hear what she heard and talk about it and everything. And then she did it for the movie. She did just that record's so beautiful. It's like her soul is, to this day, that's, I think, an Oscar performance for the all-time ages.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that they'll look
just
back
a year
on
after
that.
The Sound of Music performance by her.
Yeah, which was great, but that took it to a whole other level.
Absolutely.
That was with those, but that's, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. But when she did it for the movie, it's like the label, like no one was going to put out, like, and I remember like going, but wait, but it's so great. Like, I just, you know, so I don't give up. Mm-hmm. And so I called the producer, Paul Blaven. I said, Paul, we need a video. Without a video, we're dead in the water.
Like a music video to put on where? Like just, an MTV or
something?
Yeah,
just get it out there. Just because this song is so powerful. We have the right video. And I call Catherine Hart. And he goes, I'll help. I'll get it financed. And I go, I'll put some money in. So I put, you know, 10 grand of my own money.
Yeah.
Catherine Hardwick was going to China or something the next day. I go, I'm coming over. She goes, I can't do it. I don't have any time.
Because you guys knew each other from where?
Yeah. Well, I just met her you know, one of these, this time of year.
Yeah.
And we became really good friends. She's really good friends of mine. So I went to her house and I go, I'm coming to your house. Kind of like I didn't want to take no for an answer.
Right.
I go, I'm just going to play you the song. I'm not going to send it to you.
Yeah.
I play her the song. She goes, fuck you. You know, fuck.
Because she knew she's
stuck. Knew. She goes, I have to do it.
Yeah.
And so she got, so she put her own money in it. She got like Nikki Reed and all these actors to do it for free. And it was so powerful. And Gaga's not even in the video. I don't even know if they knew it was being done at the time, you know, but.
You didn't want the song to die, and you also felt the song could help people.
I thought it was a hit record, too. I thought it was a powerful, I thought it was every bit as great as, like, I Don't Want to Miss a Thing or something. And every time I'd play it for somebody, they would, like, be in tears, you know? And I'm like, no, I'm not going to let this die. I'm not going to let them get their way. It's not going to sit in a documentary that came, great as the documentary was, it came and went in 5 minutes, like, you know, great.
Some people referred to this video as like a PSA. You didn't like
that,
right?
Made us call. That's a whole other thing. Okay, so the label and management at the time, I guess they didn't want her to have a video once they kind of knew what was going on. And it's not a PSA. It's a genius piece of art that Catherine Hardwick did. By the way, I don't know, what's the limit on shorts for an Oscar?
Yeah,
that should have been, that was really a genius.
Yeah.
Video. It was the acting and the storyline. I mean, just the cool thing about that song and the video is even in Gaga's performance where she starts out kind of slow and then she gets angry and then she at the end she's like, you know, that's how it is with the, in the video where they're like, you see these kids, what they went through at the end, they're marching down those hallways. It was so powerful. And then literally it came out, you know, I think I sent it to Oprah and she tweeted it out and it like, it got like 5 million views in 3 hours. And Gaga's not even in there.
Yeah.
So it just, and then that kind of got.
And we should be clear though, correct me if I'm wrong, but like my sense was always that Gaga personally was very into and supportive of the song, but the label was just being a little restrictive.
Oh yeah, Gaga loved the song.
She played it every. I saw her at the PGA Awards playing.
Well, that was
it
after. No, that was after though.
After
so,
the video.
Yeah, that was after because the video leaked, quote unquote. I wonder who helped with that.
Right.
But I, things happen. But
right.
But I had help because my friend Bonnie helped me a lot with that. But no, Gaga always loved the song. I think it was just they were overthinking it and all this. A movie song from a documentary or whatever.
Right.
I get it. But I never gave up on it. And so, and anyways, once the video, quote unquote, leaked, and then I sent it to Oprah, and then, you know, 5 million views in 3 hours or whatever, that thing went on fire. And I remember, and Gaga called me, and she was crying. She goes, oh my God, I'm so happy. My fans, I'm getting, you know, tons of, like, because on Twitter, people were just, you know, this song is saving my life right now, and you know, and then it got Me Too start. So it's just like, you know, look, I'd had my own experience with being molested when I was a kid, and I never really talked about it. I mean, I think I told my mom later years. I never told my dad. My dad probably would have killed my friend's dad.
You know, when you said you were like 12.
I was 12, and I remember being at the Times Talk in New York, and Gaga and Amy and Kirby, the directors, and I blurted out like, I was molested at 12. I'm like, to a room of strangers.
Yeah.
And it just kind of got me talking too. So it's just, that's a powerful
that
song.
It became infectious. Like you said, the whole society suddenly started to.
Everybody started like going like, oh yeah. And even in that room in the Times Talks, I remember going like, how many of you have had things like that? Well, everybody in that room raised their hand.
Yeah. It's amazing. No, earlier you mentioned that there had, aside from Because You Loved Me, there was one other time when you thought you were going to win. And I'm guessing it was this one.
It was.
Because I remember.
You had that at number one.
No, I think everybody thought. And
No, everybody, like everywhere I went, like that's when she embraced it and she was playing it everywhere.
Got
everybody.
It, yeah.
Yeah. And
I guess the thing that I took away is that it's just a challenge. Songs are nominated by the music branch of the Academy.
Yeah,
that's only people that know about music.
Yeah.
Then the final round, it goes to the entire Academy. And many of them have not been as diligent about watching documentaries.
Yeah, they did. You see the hunting ground, and you look at the visual. It looks like a horror movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and most of those people, and there are a lot of men, they're not going to, you know, I mean, you know what I mean?
But more than anything, they can only, they say, I can only pick from movies that I've seen, and, oh, there's a Bond song.
Right, exactly. And then you have like a studio, you had, was it Sony, you know, working that, and you had, you know, which is, there's the weird irony. Harvey Weinstein's company put out The Hunting Ground. How weirdly ironic is that?
I know. Well, he also made the documentary Bully.
I know, right? Isn't that weird? You can't even like make
no.
that up. But and now in hindsight, maybe that's why he wasn't working the songs. He wouldn't put any money in a campaign and stuff. We literally, you know, did it on our own. I did it on my own, as usual.
The thing that I felt sorriest about, I remember And I think it will one day you will be able to laugh about it. So at the Oscars, usually I'm one level off the ground. They have nominees and their families and everybody are ground level. The nice thing about it is you have within your peripheral vision all of the nominees. So at the moment that the winner is called, you can see, you see the winner, you see everybody. No, it wasn't that you were crying. It's just that because like you, I was confident that it was going to be you.
Did you hear
was there a sigh? There was a bit of a gasp in the room. So they say whatever the song was called from Bond movie.
I remember it.
And there's a bit of a gasp in the room.
Yeah,
and
I thought that was in my head.
No. And I just will... Like, remember, you kind of almost like doubled over. And it was the moment where I thought the most of Gaga that I've ever felt because you were sitting next to each other. And I think she was a little comforting and nice
about
it.
She was
and
really
I was,
cool.
I thought that, you know.
I was upset.
I don't blame you. It was like when the whole world's telling you finally after 30 years and 8 nominations or whatever it was at that point.
Yeah, and that, I'm not saying this in an egotistical way, but it kind of deserved it.
I thought it was great.
You know, I wish they could do was, okay, you guys get to vote after the performances.
Right, because, it killed.
Right?
It killed.
It's like, okay, you know, Sam Smith, he's cool, but you saw one of the best things ever when those kids came out.
They really,
You know, I told her when, you know, she had had her own sexual assault story, and I said, when you're on stage, you're going to kill him.
Yeah.
And I remember looking in her eyes. You're going to kill your assaulter.
Oh, the person.
When you're on that stage, and I remember this one moment, and when I look back on the video, I saw it again, where she did. She went to such a place in that performance, and she hit a note in full voice, which is impossible, but she did it. And I remember just the room, like people just stood up and they stood up for like 10 minutes or something. I was looking around, seeing grown men crying.
Absolutely.
You know, Steven Spielberg, they were crying.
Should remind, that what we're saying she was surrounded by on stage were
actual victims,
actual survivors or whatever of sexual assault.
Who'd written things on their arm. You're not alone. You're kind of like what the video did. They kind of, what Catherine had people do.
Yeah, it was amazing. And the other image of that particular Oscars that I won't forget is that
And the winner is?
That was the one we've already talked about. But that at the end of that song with the huge standing ovation, the segment ends, they cut the commercial. Now you've got, I don't remember, maybe a couple dozen survivors of sexual assault who are up on the stage.
Yeah.
And I don't think it had been fully worked out like where they were supposed to go at that point, because it's not like there suddenly are a bunch of seats in the audience. So they were kind of like hustled down onto the area right in front of the stage, right in front of the front row of the audience. And I'm sure you were probably back with Gaga or whatever at that moment.
I was probably like just
or zoned
shocked.
Out or
yeah,
shocked.
I was
you know, Brie Larson, who had played a sexual assault survivor in Room for which she would win that night, hugged every single one of the survivors as they passed her in the
front
row.
Isn't that great? I did hear about
that. That was pretty amazing.
That's beautiful.
The second to most recent nomination, number 9, was for Stand Up for Something for the movie Marshall, performed by Andra Day and featuring Common. So basically you hear they're making a biopic about Thurgood Marshall. It's going to be directed by Reginald Hudlin, who you dealt with probably at the Oscars.
I was frustrated because I had done something for, I'm not even going to say what movie it was, and the director, and everybody wanted the song. This was the year before that. And I happened to be having lunch with my friend, and I said, I'm so bummed out because this is the perfect song for and she goes, oh, you should hear, my cousins wrote this movie about Thurgood Marshall that Reggie Hudlin is directing. I go, oh, I know Reggie from
he produced the Oscars.
So I met him there, and he sent me the script, and I wrote Stand Up for Something for that.
And this was really an anthem in the sense of the same way that like some of these 60s call to action, you've got to literally stand up for something. And
so appropriate now.
Totally. But what were the ones that you're thinking of as inspirations for that? When you're
on that one, I listened a lot to Change Is Gonna Come.
Sam Cooke.
Yeah. Sam Cooke. I thought Andra Day would be the perfect artist for it.
Yeah.
And then I saw the movie, she actually plays like a Billie Holiday character, which is so weird.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, what if you put like a rapper on one of those songs? Because those days there weren't rappers.
No.
So if you kind of juxtapose two very...
It's like Black Klansman with Charlottesville at the end.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah,
that was so well done.
Yeah.
And good for Spike Lee.
Yeah.
And Terrence Blanchard. And I remember, and I was on a plane to Sundance, and Common was in back of me. And I go,
you're thinking we need like a rapper like Common.
Yeah. And he's sitting in back
and
of
then
me
you
like,
get on the plane.
Never want to waste an opportunity.
No.
I started singing him part of the song for him. And he goes, oh, I love that. He goes, send me the song. And literally the next morning, I had all these missed calls from him.
That's
great. Wanted to do it. And We did that.
I loved during that season. I guess it was just a season ago when, you know, I did a Q&A with you guys, and I think we're looking at just the room, and it's like, on the surface, you guys look like an odd couple. But yeah, on the other hand, these are two great musicians.
And he's like the, he's very articulate. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, you know, fuck this. it was kind of a funny combo, right? I had fun with him.
No, he's a great guy.
He's great. And him and Andrew worked so hard. Like, yeah, they were everywhere with that song.
And the only problem there was that the movie didn't get seen.
Yeah. That's the, you know.
Yeah, it's not,
man, you
can
just
do about that.
I think the last three, yeah, I guess the new one, it's not going to go. The last three movie studios I did songs for went bankrupt.
Really?
or they don't exist. I know. Well, not bankrupt. They don't exist. Like, yeah, Weinstein for Till, yeah, It Happens to You.
Well, that's not
Relativity.
Yeah.
And they owed me money too. But
they,
whatever.
They
don't exist. And Open Road, I don't know if they're around anymore.
Well, and RBG is Magnolia. Yeah. Or who's
Magnolia participant in CNN? I don't think
they're
any of those. Yeah, CNN's
gonna,
yeah, be around,
not going,
I
anywhere,
think.
All right. You know? So that brings us to Astronom number 10, which is for I'll Fight, yeah, for the documentary RBG about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Another Supreme Court judge.
That's your other.
Do you know that story?
Which story?
Before I was born, my dad's last name was Wolfberg.
Oh.
And dealing with anti-Semitism, you know, he was having a hard time, you know, getting clients and getting indoors to sell them insurance. And my mom suggested Warren from Chief Justice Earl
Warren.
Because
of Earl Warren.
Yeah. I'm not sure if he was a chief justice at the time. He later did become one, but...
Well, you could have also become Diane Brandeis.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that doesn't sound Jewish.
It doesn't sound as... Yeah, that's right. It's not hiding it as much.
Yeah.
Well, so your second of the potentially Supreme Court justice trilogy was RBG, and you got Jennifer Hudson to do this,
yeah,
one.
Yeah, you know why she was so perfect for it is when you see the movie and you see Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's very... How soft-spoken she is. Yeah. And her mom said, always speak like a lady. But what she said was loud and it resonated and it was powerful, you know, and you see her working out. So she's like, she's a diva. And I thought, I want to get the vocal avatar for that. Who's the diva? Jennifer Hudson.
That's so funny. You know, to think about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and come up with Jennifer Hudson.
Right.
No,
the opposite. Because it's like if Ruth Bader Ginsburg is, and she loves opera. So she does love big voices. But so if she could pick somebody, you know, because it's not an operatic song, but. Okay, it'd be Jennifer Hudson,
it's a big voice.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Jennifer, you know, I think she that song resonated with her because she was going through some stuff at the time, mm-hmm, and she goes, "This is not only did you write this for the movie, but this is sounds like you wrote it for me."
And
here
what
we
about
are.
Was that one that just kind of poured out, or that took a lot of effort?
They all take effort, but you know, I got inspired, you know, and mm-hmm, and you know,
from
just,
seeing the duck.
Yeah, and you know, yeah. So just wanting to write the song that could capture her essence.
And
you know,
so when the documentary has been,
and I'm glad they got
very well received, and the thing,
and by the way, a movie that somebody saw.
Well,
what
that's what I want to say, because like, you know, the one notable difference between this and the last documentary that you did a song for is that unlike The Hunting Ground, unfortunately, you know, that wasn't seen. This one really was, did a lot of business at the box office. And unlike
who
The Hunting
knew?
Ground, was nominated for Best Documentary Feature as well.
I'm so happy for Julie Cohen and Betsy West. She's more important every day. I mean, she really is a real life superhero.
Yeah.
And every time we hear something about a health issue, like you could just hear everybody's holding their breath. Yeah. Like she's, you know.
And then you hear she's working from the hospital. Like it's unbelievable.
She's going to bounce back, you know, because she has to. But isn't it crazy to think that a movie about Ruth Bader Ginsburg did $14 million in
that's
the box
right.
office? Isn't that great?
No.
But I think it's also because the love story, too. There's a lot. She's so inspiring, everything about her, especially like who can work. She's 85 and she does that. And
one of the songs you guys are, or one of the songs that you are up against in the category is by your old pal, Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
Shallow from the film Star is Born. And I believe... You also contributed to that film as well. Can you just give the
I did the most un-Oscar song in that movie, which was Why Did You Do That, aka the butt song.
This is the one that she's singing when
she's on SNL
and Jackson Maine comes to see her and he feels that she's sold
my
out.
Line. He quotes my line. He goes, why did you come around here with an ass like that? Well, guilty. That's my line. So I can go from writing songs for Ruth Bader Ginsburg
to
writing
songs about your ass like that. Anyway, no, it's just amazing that, again, the range is incredible and people can tell that from everything we've been talking
about.
Wouldn't
that have been funny if that got nominated and then done as a ballad by Celine Dion?
Why'd you come around with an ass like that?
Really all very melodic. with strings.
Right.
It's like, I don't
know. You and Gaga working together again there. That would be the follow-up.
It'd be like, well, here's our new version of Till It Happens to You.
I'm not sure it has as much social relevance,
maybe
but
not.
People would enjoy it. But
maybe not.
All right, let's close with what we call rapid fire, just the first thing that comes to your mind. We're going to be brief with each one of these.
Okay.
Who's the greatest songwriter of all time?
There's so many. Irving Berlin.
There's
so many.
Well, I know you've talked about
my dear friend Holland, Lamont Dozier. So Holland Dozier, Holland, Carole King, Jerry Goffin, Stevie Wonder, Burt Bacharach, Al David, Prince. Oh, there's so many.
Man and Wild.
Man and Wild.
Who are
my Facebook friends. I mean,
really?
No, they're my Twitter friends. They're awesome. They're hardcore animal people too.
Who's the greatest singer of all time?
Oh wow, God, there's so many. Greatest singer I ever worked with was Whitney. But there's so many. Man, there's some great singer of all time.
Yeah.
Billie Holiday, Frank Sinatra, I don't know.
Who's the greatest singer who hasn't sung a Diane Warren song but you most wish had or would?
Adele is a great singer, she demoed one of my songs because she loved it. I wish she would release that. And then we did a couple songs I'd love people to hear, but she's great. But I wish I could go back in time, and I wish I could have written a song for Frank Sinatra.
Yeah,
that would have been cool.
I
wrote a song for Willie Nelson this year, or last year. It was a movie that nobody saw, too, that I wish people saw. It's called The Last Movie Star, that Burt Reynolds' last movie.
Yeah.
Oh, why didn't that movie company push that movie? It was great. Whatever.
What is the best Diane Warren song that wasn't a hit but should have been?
There's a lot. One of them is a song called Numb by Pet Shop Boys.
None by Pet Shop Boys.
Numb.
N-U-M-B.
Yeah.
Interesting. And people can access it.
Yeah, it's a great song. But I have a lot of them.
Right.
Oy.
If all Diane Warren songs were accidentally deleted from existence except one, which would you want to be saved?
I don't even want to think of that. I'm not even going to answer that.
Well, let's rephrase it.
What is the
recording of a Diane Warren song with which you are happiest?
I'm happy with so many of them, but off the top of my head, I'm just going to say I don't want to miss a thing.
Yeah. And finally, if you had not...
I don't want them to be deleted.
If you had not discovered... or been allowed to pursue your passion for music, where would you be today?
Dead.
Seriously?
For real. I wouldn't be alive. Music saved my life. When I wrote How Do I Live, that was my love song to music. Yeah, I wouldn't be around. I don't know how to do anything else. But, you know, my mom, it's not like she was trying to be mean or something. You know, what is the real chances that a girl with no one in the music business in her family is going to make a living at making music, really? Think about it. I know how lucky I am. She's right. I didn't have a plan B. I don't know how to do anything. I was like with some shady characters. Who knows where I would have gone? It wouldn't have been good.
I think you just found your Oscar speech for when the day comes.
Yeah.
It's not if, it's when.
But someday.
Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/the race. Until next time, thanks for joining us.